Greetings, everyone. My name is Barbara Heritage. I'm the Associate Director of Rare Book School at the University of Virginia. I'm also the curator of its collections. And I want to begin by thanking the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities for holding this event today. Please consider making a donation to the VFH. Your donation makes it possible for them to host these events, which are mostly free to the public. So as we begin, also do turn off your cell phones, if you could. And also, at the conclusion of this talk, you'll want to fill out a survey. They're probably already in your hands, but if you haven't gotten one, you can get one from some of our folks at the back of the room. And last but not least, before I introduce our speaker, Rare Book School will be hosting a reception on the first floor of Alderman Library at the end of this talk, and we would love to have you join us. It's over in 118 Alderman Library. I'm sure there will be a path of people proceeding over. We will have some collections displayed, and are looking forward to having you visit us over there. So, Michael F. Suarez, S.J., is University Professor at University of Virginia, and he's the Director of Rare Book School, a nonprofit institute which has a widespread reputation as the world's premier school for teaching the history of books and manuscripts. Michael is a Distinguished Presidential Fellow of the Council on Library and Information Resources, and he was recently nominated by President Obama to be a member of the National Council on the Humanities. Michael sits on the Literacy Awards Advisory Board at the Library of Congress. Michael holds research fellowships from the American Council of Learned Societies, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University. He is also a Jesuit priest, professor of English here at UVA, honorary curator of the University of Virginia Special Collections, and editor-in-chief of Oxford Scholarly Editions Online. Over the past 6 years, Michael has published 4 books, 3 of which were named by the Times Literary Supplement as Books of the Year. His 2005 series of Lyell Lectures in Bibliography and Book History at Oxford University will be published by Oxford University Press next year. So please welcome me and join me in welcoming Michael Suarez.
Please, please, please do not give money to the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities until after you've heard the talk and been able to decide for yourself whether it was worth it or not. My talk today is entitled The Crisis of Literacy in America, but also there's an element of hope. I'd like to start out by outlining the problem, then I'd like to talk about some of the reasons for reading, and then I'd like to talk about some exemplary people who are combating the problem of illiteracy in America in ways that should be inspiring to us all, I think. So, got it? Right? How's your Polish? Yeah. So 1 in 7 Americans couldn't read any of the slides in this lecture. 1 in 7 adult Americans. That's a real problem, it seems to me. So at least 32, maybe as many as 38 million Americans can't fill out a job application. They can't read the label on prescription medicines and know how often they're to take the medication. They can't read an article in the Mac paper, USA Today, and so on. They are functionally illiterate. So we should know our own ABCs. 14% of the country is functionally illiterate. 51 million Americans read at the 5th grade level or below. And 19% of all high school graduates are functionally illiterate. What does that say about the United States of America? What does that say about who we are as a people? So I confess, you know, I'm a boring English professor. I work on 17th and 18th century British poetry. Are you asleep yet? My students are. And so I have no idea what fifth grade reading level is. But if 51 million Americans read below the fifth grade level, I need to know what the fifth grade level is. So let's do some fifth grade reading. I went to the web and I got some worksheets. The great white shark is one of the most recognizable sharks in the world. And you can read for yourself. That's fifth grade. This is fifth grade. Million Americans can't read that or would have difficulty reading that. So I'd like to talk about Rosa and Tanya, if I may. Rosa, let's say, they're fictitious names and images I just grabbed off the web, I confess, but this I know. Both of these girls are born in the United States of America. Rosa, let's say, to a single parent family whose mother has no high school diploma and maybe even no GED. There are no books in the home, or very few. Mama works because she has to. When Rosa starts grade one, at the age of six, she comes to school with about 800 working vocabulary words. She is not read to, and books are not part of her life, and her mother, busy as she is, does not have a lot of time to talk to her. Now, Tanya is born in the same year, and both her parents went to college. There are books in the home, and she is read to every night. She hears adult conversation all the time. And when Tanya goes to the first grade, she has a working vocabulary of 8,000 words. 10 times Rosa's vocabulary. Now here's the thing. Rosa has until the end of grade 3 to catch up. And if she doesn't, she never can. She never can. So the great Nobel Prize winning economist whom I recommend... Let's put that a little further down, shall we? That is the NSA unhappy that there's an implied criticism of the American educational system. I'm not sure they can get me on satellite, but through the wiring, they're clearly here. So Sen won the Nobel Prize for economics, talking partly about this concept of deprivation. He compared the life of a girl in India to the life of an affluent girl in the United States of America and what her chances were, relatively speaking. But what Sen didn't tell us was that Rosa and Tanya have very, very different odds of ever succeeding in the world. If one shows up to the first grade with 8,000 vocabulary words and the other one shows up with 800 vocabulary words. To go from 800 to 8,000 in 3 years of grade school, the deprived child will require massive amounts of intensive help, reading materials in the home, and a revolution in parental engagement. That is almost certainly not likely to happen given the child's home situation. So, What are the consequences for the child who has those 800 vocabulary words? For the rest of her life, she's 61% likely to earn very, very low wages. And those of you who like graphs can read the bad news. Wage disparity is a problem among women in the United States anyway, but it's profoundly exacerbated for low literacy women. So if this woman can't read to level, she's condemned to low wage earnings and very likely to repeat the home situation of her own mother. The United States is shocking in the league tables for literacy, performing fourth out of the five leading English-speaking nations and 16th out of the top 23, the land of the free and the home of the brave, is a place where many citizens can't read. So some people like to talk about the cost of low literacy like this. They say, well, we lose $80 billion in lost worker productivity. Okay, I'm not sure how you know that, but that's an interesting thing, $80 billion. Between 7 and 17% of the total national healthcare costs in America are because of low literacy. People not being able to follow the physicians or the nurses or the pharmacists' instructions. 17%? What if it's 7%? What if it's 10%? These are billions with a B, but you can read, I forgot, I'm sorry, right? So sometimes people say if... Okay, right? I'm a Jesuit and the NSA is after me. I think you guys maybe should leave the room. So some people will say if you spend a dollar on literacy, you get more than $7 in return. So why wouldn't we do that? You know why? Because low literacy families don't vote. That's why. So this is just the cost associated for one county in 1 year because of low literacy. Healthcare, assistance, corrections, education, millions and millions. So this is one way to look at it. You know, we could improve the tax base because more people would know how to read and more people would then earn higher wages. I think this is not the reason why we want to increase literacy in America. It's an important attendant factor, but why wouldn't we do it for the basic humanitarian right of being able to read? So 85% of juveniles who pass through the criminal justice system are low literate. 85%, they can't read. Now, the first thing you learn in the social sciences is that a correlation is not a cause. But that's a pretty high number. About 70% of American inmates have literacy problems. So I got involved in the world of literacy and illiteracy way back in 1985 when I was 25 years old. And I asked my Jesuit superiors if I, as a white man of privilege, could go work in the Rikers Island prison system. At the time, Rikers Island was, I don't know that it still is, the largest prison in the world. It had 10 facilities and 13,500 inmates on the island in those 10 facilities. I worked 5 days a week in in a men's facility and one day a week in a woman's facility. And I discovered that about 60% of the inmates were developmentally disabled, and about, in my prison, about 80% of the inmates could not write their names. The women were far more literate than the men, but even so. So this, I ended up spending a lot of time trying to teach people how to read and write, which wasn't my job, but it was my job, right? And I had no training to do it. So this is Rikers Island. It still exists today. There's no reason for us to imagine that Rikers is atypical. So the largest population of low literate people in America is in our prisons. And of course, the United States of America has the highest incarceration rate of any nation in the world, at least for those who report their numbers. So when I left Rikers, I went to a home for unwed teenage mothers in the Bronx. This was sort of the flip side of the work that I was doing on Rikers. And yes, it's true, I ended up being a Lamaze labor partner about 17 times, but that's another story for another day. And in the institution where I was working, Rosalie Hall, as it was called, there was a hospital public school. They've now eliminated this program of public schools in chronic care hospitals. Of course, pregnancy is not an illness. But the average age of the pregnant women was 15. There were some 13-year-olds, but there were also some 16 and 17-year-olds, of course. And the average reading level by the New York City public school measure was third grade, ninth month. So these were, as it were, children having children. A real problem, and the cycle of poverty and the cycle of low literacy go hand in glove. So there is a tendency, I think, toward some magical thinking about literacy, and I'd like to issue a disclaimer before we go further. I believe that literacy is a fundamental human right. I believe that literacy is a key to many social goods. But if we eliminate illiteracy and low literacy in America, we will not magically solve all the social ills of the nation. Prejudice will not evaporate. Wage disparity will not evaporate. The death of African American youths at the hands of gun violence won't suddenly go away because they can read David Copperfield, I can assure you. Social problems are deeply complex problems, and they're imbricated in the social fabric of the United States. So we shouldn't be facile here and say, oh, I get what Michael's saying. Teach everybody how to read and all our ills go away. No. But this is a social ill that cries out for redress. And it's something that each one of us has the power to help solve. And that's one of the reasons, to me, whose life is so full of language and beautiful words as an English professor, it's really important to me that we think about this, but not in a magical thinking way. On your left, Goethe. On your right, Aristotle. These are my reminders not to get magical. Because we know that in the Nazi death camps, the most popular reading matter for the German guards was the great German poet and novelist Goethe. So you can read Goethe all day and still put 6 million Jews to death. Okay? So that tells me don't be magical. But it's also true that Mr. Aristotle tells me that freedom is not the ability to do anything you want. In the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle tells me that freedom is the ability to choose the good and to do the good. And it seems to me that without reading, it's very hard, very difficult indeed, to know the good, to choose the good, and to do it. So the average American reads at the eighth grade level. This is the eighth grade level. It's estimated that 15% of all Americans are literacy proficient, which is like being a freshman in college. So we are a privileged few, and I think we need to know ourselves as a privileged few, because the world we live in makes us forget that this is the level that most citizens exist in. So the health literacy issue is near and dear to me and very big. So 77 million people in the United States have basic or below basic healthcare literacy. 77 million people. What does that mean? Well, below basic means that you could identify what you could drink if somebody hands you the directions and it says, do not drink milk taking this medication. And you could probably get that, although there are levels of below basic. Below basic means somebody could say, circle the date on this calendar because that's when your medical appointment is. Okay, that's the highest literacy level of 14% of all adult Americans. So basic is if I give you a pamphlet and I say you need to get treated for sickle cell anemia, one, because it could kill you, and two, because there's no way you can know you have it unless we test you, you could understand that. So, okay. But intermediate is that you could tell what time you're supposed to eat when you read the prescription bottle and what time you're not supposed to eat when you take the medication. That's intermediate. So if we just go back for a second, 26% of the population can't do this. 26% of the population can't read the prescription bottle and say, I don't take this with food, or I do. Huh. So, and of course the distribution is not entirely even, is it? It's not evenly distributed at all. Another reason why literacy doesn't have great advocates in the political sphere is because it's minorities who are the most low literate population in the United States. So you can see that the health literacy problem in the United States is costly and enormous. And you would think that it would be in our national interest to find some redress for that immediately, no? So individuals who have low literacy have a shorter life expectancy. It's the most correlated aspect of life expectancy. Is the second most is poverty, but the highest is whether or not you can read. I won't bore you, but I've spent the last couple of weeks reading in preparation for a summit at the Library of Congress on health literacy, articles from the Journal of Nursing, for example, which say it's nearly impossible to get someone who's diabetic to manage their care properly if they can't read, for example. People who have low literacy have profound lost quality of life, whether it's managing their finances, having those lower wages that we saw, the increased likelihood of substance abuse, and so on. And for me, maybe one of the non-trivial one is what I call no joy of Lex, the joy of reading. And it seems to me that one of the great human pleasures, said the Jesuit priest, is the joy of Lex. So people who are low literacy also have a much lower degree of civic participation and make for a much less well-informed electorate. Duh. But you can see that the compression on wages is vast, and you can see that if a black man gets a high school diploma, it's the literacy gains that come from that will transform his earning potential. So again, why are we not doing that? So I'd like to think a little bit about the need to read. And I'd like to put aside all the economic arguments, which are, of course, non-trivial. What somebody makes and whether they can feed their children is indeed non-trivial. But I think that even as there is a digital divide, people not having access to digital materials, so too, I think there is a kind of literary schism, which by that I mean, I cannot imagine being deprived of reading literature. I cannot imagine being deprived of reading for enjoyment. And yet, if you're low literacy, reading is not fun at all. Low literacy people don't read for enjoyment. For me, one of the novels that makes me think about this a great deal is an immigrant novel about immigrants in Toronto, written by an immigrant in Canada, Michael Ondaatje's In the Skin of the Lion. And his protagonist, Patrick Lewis, goes to the library because there was a terrible horizon in him beyond which he could not leap. He is isolated. He is trapped in the narrow confines of his own experience. He needs to find a way to vault the wall of self. And in order to be connected to humanity, he does that partly by discovering the world of narrative in his local public library. It seems to me that Ondaatje is making a claim that reading is part and parcel of what it means to be a human being. In Charles Dickens' most autobiographical novel, David Copperfield, about a boy who comes out of poverty and into riches, much like Dickens himself, who, as you know, as a child, was sent to the blacking factory to blacken boots and to make blackening agent, what we would call shoe polish. He writes movingly about David's experience, and many people think that Dickens is writing about his own experience here. There were some books which my father left, and the mean people who had me didn't know they were there, and they saved my life, says David Copperfield. They came out a glorious host to keep me company in my isolation. They kept alive my fancy and my hope of something beyond that place and time. And he describes David as reading as if for life. I think that's very powerful. The need for narrative, the need for human connection beyond one's own self, to share in a common, broader narrative. One of my favorite short story writers at work today is a Native American from Spokane, Washington, named Sherman Alexie. And Sherman Alexie, in 10 Little Indians, the first story is called The Search Engine. No, it's not about a computer. It's about a girl. She is the search engine. Corliss is a Native American Spokane Indian who goes to Spokane River High School. The high school library, because it's in a very poor part of town, is what she describes as a phantom library. From far away on the shelves, the books look like they could be Dickens or Dickinson, but when you get close, they're only cookbooks and auto repair manuals. It's all Vogue tech. And she has to find a way to read her way out of her poverty. And miraculously, she's able to get into Washington State University, and she becomes, mirabile dictu, an English major. And she discovers the university library, which she talks about as being my Sherwood Forest. You realize over time that by getting lost in the deep wood of the library, Corliss discovers who she is. By inhabiting the magical Sherwood Forest of the depths of the stacks, this Native American woman begins to see a world beyond her reservation, her life and world of possibility opens up to her. Her heart is the search engine, and what she searches for is human connection. What would it be like not to be able to do that? So you will remember that Proust describes a good novel as a kind of optical instrument whereby the reader herself may learn to read one's own heart. A good novel, is a kind of optical instrument whereby the reader herself may learn to read her own human heart. Best thing Proust ever wrote. So why do we need that special instrument of fiction? Why do we need the recreational read that isn't extra? Because it allows us to recreate ourselves, to escape from the narrow confines of our own journey, to vault the wall of self and to become more human by becoming more humane. In the laboratory of the narrative, one can see how others behave in the world and emulate them or reject them as time goes by. It seems to me that this need for narrative, as absolutely central to our humanity, is overlooked by all the literacy advocates, and it seems to me terribly sad, because I think this is as important in some ways, perhaps romantic than I am, as the healthcare implications. Because what are we trying to do if not equip each other for great humanity? So Robert Coles, that brilliant, brilliant psychiatrist who spent so much time trying to teach Harvard medical students that they could be a little human in the way they took care of their patients. In The Call of Stories, a book I recommend to you most ardently, he says, why would we read? We do it in order to heighten our own self-understanding and our understanding of the other people in the world. So, here are but a few examples of some people who are trying to attack the problem of low literacy in America. So Reach Out and Read is a remarkable enterprise. A group of physicians got the idea that goes like this. Who are the professionals who a young mother just having had a child will most encounter? It's doctors and nurses on the wellness visits, those mandatory periodical checkups. At Rare Book School, we've had 5 babies over the last 4 years. I know a lot about wellness visits that I didn't know before. So by giving physicians and nurses in pediatric centers where the patients are at risk, in poor areas, a supply of books programmed for each phase of those wellness visits, Reach Out and Read has been able to help 4.5 million children every year. And that's remarkable. That's really a remarkable thing. All because somebody got the idea, what if you got the nurses to do it? What if you got the doctors to be the primary agents of promoting literacy? So when someone comes in to see the nurse on her wellness visit with her child, the nurse says, remember the prescription. You must read for 20 minutes to your child every day. That's a simple thing, but it's a transformative thing. So First Book is another group that had a really good idea, it seems to me. This is about getting books into children's hands as well, but this is a different way of doing it. The people who run First Book said, you know, we've got millions of kids who are from poverty areas in America. About 45 million children live in areas of high poverty. So, and they have good help from a lot of non-government organizations, a lot of 501c3s, but a lot of those organizations aren't so great at bargaining with publishers, and a lot of those organizations are too small to raise money. So what we're going to do is we're going to raise the money, and we're going to drive very hard bargains with the major children's book publishers in America, and we're going to find a way to give the literacy programs and the schools that serve at-risk populations all the books that they can handle at the appropriate age levels for their respective populations. This is really a clever thing. So they're a brokerage house for 1,000 literacy groups. Very, very clever. So Reader to Reader is a cluster of multiple literacy programs for children, but the one that I like best is the one in which young readers are paired online with college students, and they read together through the affordances of the web. And so the college student doesn't have to be there in person. He can do it from his dorm room or from the university commons. And there's a reading tutor on the other end of the web. That seems to me, you know, and a relationship that gets sustained. One of the problems that we find in just giving books to at-risk children is that sometimes there's nobody at home to read those books to those children. Sometimes a child who has what appears to be an insuperable reading difficulty needs a good tutor to overcome that difficulty. So this, among the many programs that Reader to Reader has, is this tutorial program to harness the lots of time that college students actually have on their hands. Reading Rockets is a social media initiative, and it helps if you have your own public television station. That makes it kind of good. But Reading Rockets uses a variety of media, including television and DVDs, live streaming, not only to reach students, but also to teach the tutors. And this, again, seems to me really important. They grab everybody. They'll give all sorts of stimulation electronically to the children, but they'll also help the teachers with lesson plans and stage development for the development of their own professional expertise. This is one that I became particularly enamored of last year on the Literacy Committee. This is United Through Reading. You know, we've been at war for a very, very long time now, and that means that de facto, many families that actually do have two parents are single-parent families. And single-parent families don't have a lot of time to read to their kids. Also, there's a problem of isolation from the mom or dad who's in the armed forces. So somebody got the bright idea, well, we could make videos of daddy reading a program series of books depending upon how old the kids are. You see a little diaper bottom going on there. So depending upon how old the child is, the person in the armed services can read on camera through the affordances of, say, a USO or a number of other on-base possibilities. And then these DVDs get mailed or sometimes streamed to households in which the children can then hear daddy or mommy reading the books that they themselves also have so that they can read along. And this helps family coherence, but it also does a great deal to help improve the literacy levels of these children who are isolated from one of their parents. Now, I vowed to myself that I was only going to talk to you about American programs, but I had to put in one exception that proves the rule, and this is it. Planet Reed is the brainchild of an Indian gentleman, I think from Gujarat, who said, I live in India, and I have a terrible problem. And that is, the literacy rate is shockingly low. But what do I know about the Indian people? They are addicted to Bollywood music videos. So if I can go to the people in Bollywood and get live captioning in the different languages where these videos are being broadcast, and you can follow the bouncing ball for all these music videos, the average person in India watches 9 of these a day. It's like MTV, only better in some ways and worse in others. So if they follow the bouncing ball, they learn how to read. because the lyrics to the songs, which they memorize anyway, become associated with the words, and they begin to see that each phoneme has a counterpart, and those clusters of phonemes make words, and there's a grammar, and. How brilliant is that? A billion people helped in their reading. Wow. This many of you will recognize as the Los Angeles Public Library. And it's a good reminder to me to remind you that last year, or the year before, the last year that we have statistics available, the library system in the United States had 1.6 billion visitors. 1.6 billion visits. So what's the main cultural institution for promotion of literacy in America? It's the public library. This is the webpage from the public library that has the highest diversity in America. This is the webpage from the Queensboro Public Library for Queens County, New York, has even greater diversity than Los Angeles County. Citizenship, community, computers, health information, jobs, learn English, learn another language, young adult literacy, and so on. And so it's the center of the solution to this problem more and more is going to be in harnessing the power of the public library in America. 1.6 billion visits. So I would encourage you to go to Google and go to the Library of Congress Literacy Awards, and you will see 3 years of best practices in PDFs, which will tell you what a lot of these organizations are nationally and internationally, and see which of these might fire your own imagination. I would say briefly that these are not just far-flung, far-away programs. Literacy Volunteers of Charlottesville and Albemarle has an extremely vibrant program going on right here in which adults are trained to be literacy tutors both for children and adults. So here we are at the Virginia Festival of the Book. And we're honoring Pulitzer Prize winners this year, the 100th anniversary. And this is fantastic. But as we celebrate the book, ladies and gentlemen, and as we revel in our power to read, as we fill our minds and our hearts with true and beautiful words, as we learn every day in ways that we don't even think about, because our parents and our teachers taught us how to read. It seems to me right that we should pause and think about those who don't know how to read. Rare Book School is a terrific enterprise to which many in the room have wielded themselves sedulously. But you know, this is about how to read the arcane features of books, how to read the print and how to read the type, how to read the illustrations and the binders, how to understand the book in history and as an agent of history. And this is an important service to the library community. But a far greater service to this community and to our country is to bear in mind and to strive to do something about the terrible problem of low literacy in America. Because if you can't read, you can't ever be free. Thank you very much. Promising to stay north of the no-fly zone, I'd be very happy to take your questions, comments, or indeed your excoriations. Please, Paul. You know, is it getting better or getting worse? It's the last numbers we have are 2014, and they seem to be just about identical to the numbers we have from a very large study conducted in 2003. So I would say stasis is what we have. It's not getting worse, but it ain't getting any better either, and that seems to me deeply problematic. Please, sir.
Reading from a print book or reading from a screen, such as your cell phone or what have you, does it make a difference as long as you read? And if it doesn't, what sort of efforts have there been to get the low literacy families, the poor families and that sort of thing, some sort of screen device for kids? Because they have a lot of tendency to read on the screen than they would say.
So does it make a difference if you read on screen or from a physical book? The scholarly literature on that is pretty confused and confusing, but it would seem that young people who only read off screens have lower levels of literacy than those who only read books, and those who have the highest levels of literacy are those who read in what the scholarly literature calls a mixed ecosystem, reading both on screens, Kindles, iPads, computers, cell phones, and physical objects, physical books themselves as well. Sometimes people say to me in my role as the director of Rare Book School, you must really hate the electronic, you know, you must hate Nooks, right? You must hate Kindles. No. Anything that makes people read is a good thing, right? Anything that helps people read is a terrific thing. And the digital is not the enemy. It never was. So anything that we can do, and that Reading Rockets program that I adduced does a lot of digital delivery of reading material to children, and in fact has some pretty nifty games to help children acquire vocabulary and something I never learned myself, learn how to spell, and those kinds of things. My philosophy is whatever works, but it appears that there's a fairly consistent trend in the scholarly literature that even for digital natives, for kids born with a mouse in their hand or a trackpad under their thumb, even for those kids, if they read about over 80% in a digital environment, they tend to have much lower levels of retention and much slower decoding, as it's called, decipherment, than children who read in the mixed system or kids who have a steady diet of those books, the printed books. Yeah. Please.
So, your statistics show that so many high school graduates or large number of high school graduates are reading below the level. How do you feel about education standards and testing? Strikes me that this is probably a good idea because obviously the schools are maybe not doing what they could. So how do you address this?
Sure. So the question is, you know, well, okay, if 19%, I'll paraphrase if I may, if 19% of high school graduates can't read, you know, and the average 51 million Americans, that the average reader, that sort of, you know, median reader, as it were, is reading at the eighth grade level, something's wrong with our education system, so what should we do about it? You know, I'm not an education policy expert, but all the studies seem to show over and over and over again that story of Rosa and Tanya that I told in the beginning is the absolute key. And I actually think that if you elect me President of the United States, I would try to put as much money as possible in early childhood education. Head Start works, you know, and so do the other early childhood education programs. So I think that the key is to make sure that Rosa and Tanya both get to the first grade when they're 6 years old with maybe not 8,000, but maybe 7,000 vocabulary words, and then they're going to be okay. It's that crucial early period that seems to me that the most important. I also think, as a teacher, I also think that once upon a time in America, it was a respected thing to be an educator, and now, alas, it's not such a respected thing, and I actually think that we need to pay primary and secondary school teachers better, and I think that we need to take some of the momentum of initiatives like Urban Teachers and Teach for America and try to revitalize the respectability of the profession, because the business of teaching ultimately is not information transfer, it's what the Greeks called paideia. It's the formation of human beings, and that to me seems a sacred task. And why we as a culture don't value that task seems very sad indeed, you know, and puzzling to me. So I think early childhood is absolutely central to the solution to this problem. Please, sir.
Having a physical parent there for someone helping and so forth, but at the same time, with children, if there is parents available, will follow the example of their parents. And the tendency now among people is using your cell phone for texting, using your cell phone for quick information, not looking up, not using, just talk to your phone. You don't have to look at any words or anything, strictly verbal. So children are seeing, I'm just talking about this greatness in the popular, but this general population is going, in my opinion, is going down also.
So the question is, well, you know, the culture of the cell phone may be deleterious to us in, again, I paraphrase, but in helping children learn how to read. I think a lot of the studies show that it matters a lot less what you read than that you read, but it's also true. I mean, as a child, I started reading the New York Times, but my father was getting the New York Times. My mother was getting the New York Times. I started to read the New York Times because in 1969, when I was 9 years old, the Knicks won the NBA championship, the Mets won the World Series, and the Jets won the Super Bowl. And I became an addict of the sports pages. And there was some pretty darn good sports writing. So it doesn't matter what you read. I mean, that's hardly Proust, right? But it doesn't matter what you read, but that you read. And I think that even reading on a cell phone, most kids have pretty good eyes, is totally okay. But there's something about, to what you say, about the need for what's called in the literature immersive reading. The idea of getting lost in a story, that need for narrative as being part and parcel of, I think, what it means to be a human being. I earnestly believe that. And I think later on, learning about poetry and how to understand and cherish the value and power of language. But there's a woman at Tufts. Her name is Marilyn Wolfe. And she wrote a totally cool book, I never thought Proust would come up twice, called Proust and the Squid. And she's a developmental psychologist, and she's on the medical faculty at Tufts Medical School. And she had students and adults both perform certain tasks while she had them in magnetic resonance images and PET scans and CAT scans and all that kind of stuff to look at different aspects of brain activity. And what she discovered in her book called Proust and the Squid is that if you were decoding information, if you were sorting search results, you sunder synaptic connections in your brain. She says in the book, you can watch the synapses break in the human brain as they're just trying to process information. And separate it out. Sheep, sheep, goat, 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 sheep, goat, sheep, sheep, goat. That's not good for the brain. But then she had them do what she called deep reading, where you got lost in a narrative. And she said, you could watch for children and even older people as they got lost in the narrative, as they became immersed in the story. Synapses were forming in the human brain. The brain was becoming more highly connected and more puissant, more able, more forceful as somebody was reading a story. And so am I worried that in 1964, the average sentence in Time and Newsweek had between 12 and 14 words in it, and now the average news magazine, not The Economist, sentence has 5 to 6 words and no relative and dependent clauses? You bet I am, because it seems to me that those relative and dependent clauses are how you qualify, how you nuance, right? And I think as the world becomes, dare I say, more complex, perhaps not more complex, but as the complexities of the world present themselves to us, we need nuanced thinking. If the only tool you have in your hand is a hammer, then every problem looks a lot like a nail. So I think that, you know, Thomas Jefferson believed that the aim of a university and the aim of education more generally was to equip people for citizenship so that they could be judicious judges and help the commonweal to thrive. And I don't know what being raised on a diet of 5 to 6 word sentences is going to do to help the commonwealth thrive. Please.
I hate to bring up the current political environment, but I will. The current political environment has shown us rage, I think, in a set of population. Is that connected to what you're talking about? No.
It's a good question. So is the anger among voters connected to, in some way, the fact that such a high proportion of the American population is by any means undereducated? I'm not a fit judge. And again, think about the image with the book and the magic coming out of the book, right? I'm a little hesitant. I'm a lot hesitant to sort of imagine that reading is a kind of panacea or a golden key. I think that our social ills are far more complex. In my experience in Rikers Island, you know, everybody, every man and woman in that facility could have been writing David Copperfield, and it wouldn't have solved all the problems that were in the culture. So I don't want to turn literacy into the fall guy or into the instant solution. But I do think that the more ably one reads, the more nuanced are one's own ideas. And I would argue, as others have before me, that the moral faculty in human beings is the imagination. That it's by being able to imagine what it would be like to be in that other person's situation that we are able to behave compassionately towards toward that other person? Well, it seems to me the imagination is a muscle, and we need to exercise those muscles or it will get a bit flabby. So perhaps what we're really experiencing is, in some sense, in our current situation, a failure of compassion, which may be partly due to a failure of the human imagination, which may be linked indeed to not having those immersive experiences. But again, I am way beyond my ken here. I'm unable to make that kind of judgment.
And unfortunately, we do need to wrap it up here, but the conversation can continue over on the first floor of Alderman Library. So Michael will be walking over, and I'm sure he'd be delighted to take more questions over there, first floor of Alderman Library.
Thank you very much. Thank you.